Welcome to the latest edition of the Watercolors Aquarium Gallery podcast, brought to you from the Aquarium Rush Studios in Grand Rapids, Michigan. My name is Ben.
I'm Amy.
And I'm Charles.
Today we're talking about cleanup crews.
Woohoo.
It doesn't seem like something that someone would have a strong opinion about. It's just, you know, you have some algae, you throw a snail in. But I kind of do have a strong opinion about it.
I have a lot of strong opinions on this topic. And you're going to tell me what kind of allergy eater to put in my fish tank, right?
What kind of allergy eater, yes. Nice.
That's one of my favorite lines.
I know. We get that one a lot. Charles, what do you think about the idea of cleanup crews?
I think they are one of those things in the hobby that everyone thinks they know how they work, and most people don't actually think about how they work.
Because they clean the tank, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. They keep your tank clean so you don't have to, right?
Yeah. Not quite.
So we're going to loosely organize this talk a little bit by talking about what a cleanup crew is for. And yes, I worded that carefully because there's another part to that. What are some good cleanup crew residents and some bad ones and why? And then we're going to get to the controversial stuff about why you need a cleanup crew. Maybe it's because you're bad at tank maintenance. But we'll save that part for later.
So how do we approach this topic even? Because when somebody asks me, do I need a cleanup crew? Like, my instinct is generally to say, no, do you want one? Like, but there are definitely some things that do help keep your maintenance much easier. So are we going to talk through, like, I don't know, what you need a cleanup crew for first?
Yeah.
Like specific issues?
I think that's first.
Okay.
Yep.
I think it's fair to say, and I don't think we as a trio have articulated whether we're specifying a marine cleanup crew or a cleanup crew in aquaria in general.
I think this is a marine topic.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. At least this time. But in freshwater, you're usually just talking about algae eaters,
right?
Which is kind of a shame because there are some other cool cleanup crew members in a freshwater tank that are not algae eaters.
Right. I just need a big old pleco.
Suckerfish.
Suckerfish. That's right. I need a suckerfish because my tank's dirty.
The way modern freshwater aquariums are handled, I'm kind of under the opinion that a cleanup crew or even just an algae eater really isn't necessary because, unlike a marine aquarium, where you are trying to replicate a ecosystem, there's a lot less moving cogs.
I'd like you to bring that up in the third section of this discussion.
Okay.
That's kind of part of the point that I'm going to try to make. And I'm going to make that point, I think, in both a freshwater and a marine environment.
Okay.
So let's first talk about what a cleanup crew is for. Maybe we should start what it's not for. It's not because you feed your tank too much or you keep your tank too dirty. What it's for most of the time, what most people want a cleanup crew for, is to consume nuisance algae.
Yeah.
Like, that's got to be...
Except for maybe just, like, the sand sifters and that's, like, there's not a ton in that, but we should at least go over sand sifting and pest removal of other kinds, too.
That's why I'm going with, you know, 90%, maybe I should say 70% algae removal.
Yeah.
Some kind of algae.
Right.
Right. So we have a little bit of an attitude around here about a certain common member of the marine cleanup crew that sometimes is a little on the unpopular side. And you know us, we like to push that envelope a little bit. We like to touch a nerve now and then. So let's talk about our friend the hermit crab. Let's start with those guys, right? That is a common member of a cleanup crew. And there's a couple of online sellers out there that sell cleanup crews by the gallon. You have a 75-gallon tank, therefore you need 6 turbo snails, 12 astrea snails, and blah, 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 blah.
Every 75-gallon aquarium's the same, right?
Exactly. And then you need 12 red-leg hermits and 12 blue-leg hermits. The moment of silence was on purpose. That moment of silence was for all of the astrea snails that are going to get eaten by the hermit crabs.
Rest in peace.
Rest in peace.
I think it's more I think it's more accurate to say rest in pieces.
It's even a misconception. People will be like, oh, well, they just do that to take their shells. And if they have enough shells, then they're not going to do that. No, they just really like eating snails.
Yeah, they like to try shells.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's really hard on a snail to have somebody try out their shell.
Yes.
Hard on in the meaning it does kill them.
Yeah, and the hermit crab does not care either way. Frankly, I love hermit crabs. I think they're a lot of
fun. Adorable.
They're adorable. The colors are really cool. I just wouldn't keep them in a tank. I'd try to keep snails in, and if cleanup crew is what you want, snails are better cleanup crew.
Yes. The common algae that people buy hermit crabs for is hair algae. And trochus snails and turbo snails are great eaters of the same kinds of hair algae that hermit crabs eat.
Yeah, even emerald crabs will go for hair algae some too.
They'll go for a lot of the tougher stuff that the turbos won't touch, and then you can skip the hermit crabs. If you're curious about that, or if you don't believe me, come look at any of our reef tanks. There's not a single hermit crab in there, well, at least not on purpose, and there's no hair algae. So...
I would really like to get one of those giant hermits one time just to have it.
They're really cool.
They're really interesting animals.
Yeah. The Caribbean red starry hermit crab.
Yeah.
Is the one.
Yeah.
And they'll get up to the 8-inch mark. I mean, they'll take some monster conch shells. They're super fun.
There's no harm in keeping an invertebrate just because you like an invertebrate. But if algae eating is what you want, don't go with a hermit crab.
Yep. Agreed. They're crazy hardy.
Oh, yeah.
Like almost frighteningly so.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah. So, okay. So let's break it down by algae types, right? Because we're gonna first talk about what is a cleanup crew for. And most of the time, it's for eating algae. And a marine aquarium, the common algaes that are consumable by cleanup crews, the brown diatom algaes, Ostrea snails, trochus snails do a great job.
And those are going to be like the spottier algaes, sometimes film on the glass, but usually I think diatoms are going to show up on the rock and sand.
The brown filmy stuff on the glasses.
Okay.
Yeah, particularly at the beginning when you're going through a cycle.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where that's going to show up.
But usually the later stage, you're going to see more of the green stuff on the glass than the brown, at least from what I've seen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Ostreas are going to do a great job taking care of that too.
Either way. I was just trying to define what word, because they can't, like, we can all picture it in our heads, but they can't see what we're talking about.
Right.
So that brown diatom algae is that brown, slimy stuff. A lot of the times on the rocks and sand, but sometimes on the glass.
Almost looks like a dust on the glass. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so in many reef tanks, a good group of Ostrea snails is a fantastic addition for that.
And I think if you're first setting up your tank too, I wouldn't even worry about it. Because that's going to show up, and even it consumes a lot of the silicates in your sand. So once it gets past that stage, unless there's more to fuel that algae, you probably won't get too much of a resurgence in a new tank. If you're seeing it in a more mature tank, then get some cleanup crew to take care of that. But in a new tank, you might just want to wait and see.
I think you touched on a really important point, that don't go buy a cleanup crew based on how big your tank is. Buy a cleanup crew based on what you're seeing in your specific aquarium.
Yeah.
If you're not seeing any film algae on anything, don't bother with Ostrea snails.
Yeah.
Spend the money on something more fun than that.
Right.
Each marine aquarium that someone sets up becomes its own kind of like, I don't want to say ecosystem because it's not truly like that sort of trophic leveling, but it does have its own unique equilibrium that is really hard to replicate because each aquarium kind of does it a little different. So trying to like shotgun cleanup crew isn't really that functional.
From the microorganism population, and I'm going all the way down to the micro stuff like bacterias, we don't know what bacterias we're introducing into our aquariums, and we don't know which bacterias are going to be able to do well. Some of those are going to consume the things that algae wants. All the way to copepods and amphipods and all kinds of different pod this and pod that you may or may not need that kind of thing. And then the other factors like, how much flow do you have? What kind of lights do you have? What's your light cycle? And what's a big thing that people forget to take into account is, what is the effect of the ambient light in the room going to have? One of our service accounts is a beautifully tuned, perfectly set up, amazing aquarium with all of the bells and whistles. We have to go there twice a week to wipe the algae because there are fluorescent lights that shine on that tank. They only shine on the tank for 6 hours a day.
That's still like, that's plenty.
It's got aqua illumination Hydra 26s on it. So it's getting plenty of good light, but something about that ambient fluorescent light on that tank, it grows film algae like crazy. Yeah. We load it up with Astrea snails.
It's happened to me a couple of times, which is kind of funny, where somebody has been coming in repeatedly for an algae issue, and we've worked out all the kinks. They're not overfeeding, their nitrates are in check, their lights are on a reasonable time. They say it gets no ambient light during the day, the lights are off. And then I've had somebody come to me before saying, like, oh, I took last week off because it was Christmas or whatever. And it gets 3 hours of pure sunlight at like noon that I've never seen before. So I think like this is probably as good a time as any to say there is nothing inherently bad about algae. Other than the fact that it may cover over some corals if it gets really out of control. But yeah. Algae is a symptom to a problem, not a problem in and of itself. You got to get down to that root.
That is exactly it.
Yeah.
That is exactly it. An aquarium that has exceptionally low phosphates, exceptionally low nitrates, and doesn't get improper lighting will grow very little, if any, algae.
Yeah. Yeah. Unless something else weird is happening for some reason.
Well, and it's an aquarium, so something else weird is going to happen. Yeah.
Yeah. And we take those things as they come. But you plan your cleanup crew based on the issues you have, not guessing at the issues you think you may have in the future. That's my perspective on it.
That's the point that we try to drive home here in the shop, and that's what we're going to try to drive home here today, is that it's not a one-size-fits-all when it comes to a cleanup crew.
Yeah. So we did hair algae. We did diatoms. We touched a little bit on film algae.
Yeah.
What's next?
You know, I guess when it comes to snails, the big three that we keep around here are Astreas, Trochus, and Turbos.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally throw some Cerathes in there. Although Cerathes, I always find them in the overflows.
Yeah. They tend to like to climb up. I think they might lay their eggs out of the water.
I'll have to look into that. I'm not sure about that.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know why I have that impression, but right. I do for some reason.
Yeah. Some other things to consume those types of algaes. Urchins. Emerald crabs. We should talk emerald crabs. Emerald crabs I love. They're a blast.
Yeah, we'll have to come back to urchins, but emerald crabs for sure. They're pretty fun.
So emerald crabs are in the genus Mithrix. And I have a little theory about emerald crabs. And one of these days, maybe somebody out there can help me verify this, but when we get in emerald crabs, sometimes we get in green ones, and sometimes we get in red ones. And other than the color of the shell, they sure do look darn identical. So my working theory on this is, and again, I'm hoping somebody out there can verify this for me. So emerald crabs are almost exclusively algae eaters. When you look at their pinchers, they've got little spades on there that look like they'd be great at pinching something to pick it up, as opposed to something like a stone crab that's got this pointy thing so it can rip and tear at stuff. If you ever are curious as to, you know, how valuable that pinchy thing might be, go take a pliers and a two needles out to a blade of grass and try to pick it up.
Yeah.
The emerald crab claws look like pliers. Yeah. You could pick a blade of grass, no problem with that. Try something like pointy and sharp and pick a soup. It's not going to work.
And they can really pick up algae by the root like that.
Oh,
like
yeah.
Hair algae, whereas snails oftentimes will leave a little bit of a film. They can like get underneath it, clip it, and pull it completely up. And they can do that with bubble algae as well, which is kind of a major thing to watch.
That's one of the major fun parts about emerald crabs. And one I think their most important uses is bubble algae. They do a great job on bubble algae.
Yeah. I do have a little bit of a point on that color, actually, because I have a theory.
Okay. I wonder if it's the same as mine.
It is not the same as yours, at least the one that you just told me.
I didn't finish.
Oh. Oh.
You go.
I thought you did.
I know, I got distracted. Okay. It happens. You go.
Well, okay. My theory is, because I've got some experience with stomatopods or the mantis shrimp.
Yeah.
And somebody got it as a hitchhiker. I had them ship it up for me. It was a Neogonodactylus wenerei, which is one of the smaller mantis shrimp. When it arrived to me, it was brick red. Because it had been collected from a deeper point. Mm-hmm. And after a few molts, I think after three molts, it was bright green.
Ooh, that is a different theory than mine. So that has everything to do with the depth of the water.
Mm-hmm. And they molt to a different color if they're in shallower water under more light.
Right.
Yeah.
And in deeper water, the red wavelengths don't penetrate. And
exactly.
So they look black, or they would, the reason you see a lot of nocturnal fish as red is so that they can hide better.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so my theory has to do with you know, what your grandma used to say when you were a kid, you are what you eat.
Yeah.
Right? Emerald crabs go through a larval planktonic life stage, like many of the creatures we keep in our reef aquariums, be that fish, shrimp, crabs, all kinds of stuff. They, as plankton, they drift around the planktosphere is what that's called. And then they settle onto something. The ones that settle in the right place survive. The ones that don't settle in the right place turn into food. If a planktonic larval emerald crab lands on a patch of green algae, mm-hmm. it's got a really good shot of surviving. And it's going to eat the green algae, thus green emerald crab. Right. If that same species lands on a patch of red algae and starts eating red algae, my theory, again, not verified, right. my theory is that's where the red ones come from. What do you think, Charles? Does that have any validity?
I think there might be some validity to that. I think both hypotheses presented here might actually be, may interplay with each other, because one does not necessarily exclude the other in this case.
Mm-hmm,
because mm-hmm. I know of specific organisms where one or the other is true, or both is true.
Interesting. I mean, it could also be that they're just albino, but it's pretty fun to speculate. And there are a lot of them for them being albinos. Albinos are usually pretty rare.
Yeah, and there's too much pigment there. There's definitely pigmentation there. Okay. It's not a lack of pigmentation.
Because it is really more of pink, which I think the shell would be white if it was a true albino. Yeah.
Or white or transparent.
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, we digress, which we're really good at here. Maybe that's boring. Maybe that's interesting. But
should we get, we're still talking about algae.
We're talking about algae yeah. eaters. Yep.
Maybe we should talk about what fish make good algae eaters.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. Charles, do you want to talk to us about fish, since it'll bring you into the conversation? He's rolling his eyes at us talking about invertebrates over here. Yeah.
Hey, Charles, the fish guy.
I took a lot of notes for this one just to try and keep tabs, and you guys are beating me to everything. So I've had really good experience with lawnmower blennies, which are a personal favorite of mine. In my first reef aquarium, they're pretty good with like the hair algaes and stuff like that.
It's fun to watch them rip and tear at it.
It's absolutely
fun. In my first reef aquarium, there definitely was not enough algae to sustain him. So I would have to do that whole algae clip thing. And he was my favorite fish in the tank, because when it was empty and he wanted more, he would swing on it so it would go on the glass. And I had a very specific image in my head of him being like, "Hey, waiter, more." Like,
it's like when somebody snaps at a waiter. Right. It's that level of like entitled.
I love that. Like, isn't that the best way to eat?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. That's so funny. As a fish, I wish I could convince people on more, because they look at it and they're like, it's brown. And I want to tell them, no, it's so cute and it's
so
useful.
Call them grumpy old man fish. Yeah. Right? And all of a sudden people look at that personnel and think, I got to have one.
Yeah, because that's how I see them.
The challenge with those guys, though, is they're going to have a hard time surviving on pellets.
Yeah.
So they are going to do a good job of cleaning out the algae in a tank. But once the algae is cleared out, sometimes they'll convert over to pellets and sometimes they'll be enough. But like Charles did, algae sheets are almost a necessity for those guys.
Yeah, it's hard to find picky fish like that that don't also pick on other things when they're available.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
A lot of the tangs, there are, well, almost exclusively the tangs are algae eaters.
Yeah. Yeah. We had a flamingi tang a while back, and it was in a very large aquarium. That thing was just a machine. Mm-hmm. It was a lawnmower. It didn't matter what the algae was. Just put it in there, it was going
to
eat it.
But even the little ones, the tamini that I talked about like just a couple of episodes ago, is a fantastic algae eater.
They're so good at it.
Tang. Yeah.
Tenacatus is the genus, and that is the comb tooth tangs is their common name for that genus. And that comb tooth is for combing through hair algae. And
they're machines.
They are great at it.
Yeah. Yep. I've even seen before a coal, which is a tenacatus, right?
Yep.
Yeah. I've seen one eat like red film.
Oh, yeah.
Which.
Oh, yeah.
Is not tasty.
You can see their mouth prints in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most things do not like that. It's not worth it.
A lot of the Zebrasoma genus will eat bubble algae. The Desjardins is considered like, if you have bubble algae, put a Desjardins in there and they'll eat it. That's the red sea sailfin. Yep. I have definitely seen yellow tangs and Scopus tangs also consume bubble algae by the boatload.
Yeah. Rabbit fish too for hair algae, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's actually a number of gobies that, or a number of other blennies that are great algae eaters.
Yeah. Like starry blennies.
Starry's the court jester. Those guys will consume algae. The fang blennies, not so much.
No. They seem to be like zooplankton consumers.
Well, I don't see how they could with their teeth arrangement.
Their buck teeth.
Yeah.
All right, Amy, you were going to make some points on urchins because...
Oh, I was just saying that we need to... if we're going to say urchins will eat film algae, we need to like add asterisk on the end of it. Like,
yeah, that's very true. That's like saying fish will eat algae.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And some urchins will eat algae and some urchins will eat everything.
Right. So you want to hear my funny urchin story?
I love to hear funny urchin stories.
All right. So one of our service customers wanted something to sift their sand. And I called my wholesaler and said, hey, what's a good sand sifter? They said, hey, we just got some flower urchins in. All right, send me one of those. They sent me a flower urchin. I picked it up and I put it in the tank. And then I called the customer and said, hey, I got this flower urchin for you. And I picked it up and put it in a bag. And I brought them the flower urchin.
I know exactly where this story's going.
Charles probably knows what a flower urchin is.
Yeah. And then I got there and I acclimated the urchin to the tank and I picked it up and I, with my hands, and put it in the tank. And it did an amazing job of sifting the sand. Their sand bed was always clear. And like a month later, I see this article about dangerous marine organisms. It literally could have killed me. And like they talk about don't touch them because on contact they fire a venomous spike.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a little conversation with my wholesaler about, you know, you might have wanted, it would have been good if you warned me about that.
Right. Right.
But I just picked it up. Now, like 8 years after that, we moved that aquarium and then I was a lot more careful about moving the
I don't even care. It could be a pencil urchin. I'm not picking it up. I'm using something.
Pencil urchins are fine.
Picturing you with like the whole hazmat, like radioactive waste outfit, and you got the giant forceps, and you're like, steady.
Because even the long spines can do that sort of like injection thing. That's terrifying.
Yeah, but the long spine is going to be a little annoying and mildly painful. It's not going to actually hurt. I mean, it's not going to kill you.
No, but it's still
scary.
It's not
even a bee sting. I'm glad you brought up pencil urchins because we get requests for pencil urchins all the time. And I think that they're pretty cool and they're pretty fun and they do consume some algae.
Well, they're a boring urchin, right?
Goodness. I like the double use of that word. They do a little bit of boring, but there is also another urchin that is way more boring than pencil urchins. Pencil urchins just like to knock stuff over. They're really strong. And so if your rock pile isn't very secure and your corals aren't like really glued in, they're going to push stuff over.
Yeah.
Yeah. Picture the Hulk between two bricks saying, get out of my way. He doesn't say that. I don't know. I just made that up. But
yeah, but with no face and no feelings.
Urchin smash.
Urchins don't get angry. They're always angry.
Yeah.
They're just what they are. The boring urchins are actually a rock boring urchin, and they will consume live rock.
Yeah.
Bore right through them. So she wasn't talking about them as being unexciting.
Although a lot of them are pretty dull looking.
Yeah, well, the purple ones are cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So which ones are good for algae? There's royal...
The royals are pretty good, although royals like to hide themselves under debris, and so that if your corals aren't attached really well, they'll pick one up and put them on their back and use it as camouflage.
Which is kind of cute until it's not.
Right.
Tuxedo urchins.
Yeah.
Do the same thing. And I think tuxedo and royal are synonymous. That's the same critter, isn't it?
I wrote down Mespilia. Genus? Mespilia.
Uh-huh. That's nice.
Okay.
Yeah, that means nothing to me, right?
Okay.
I did not write down the genus or don't know the genus, but I think tuxedo and royal.
They're really similar.
I think
even
that's the same urchin.
I've seen like ones that look different, but that's meaningless. Right. I think we're all a little out of our depth here with invertebrate taxonomy.
The royal urchin, there's the star urchin. Couple of other urchins that are non-venomous
yeah
and can eat some algae They're a little on the touchy side. Actually, the royal urchins, those things are going to last forever. They're really hardy. The long-spined urchin is a really classic-looking, beautiful organism that that does a pretty decent job at eating some algae.
Yeah, and as long as you know where they are, I'm not worried about putting my hand in a tank with a long-spined urchin.
Always got to know where those guys are. You're afraid of pencil urchins, but not long-spined?
No, I would never pick it up.
Oh, okay.
But it's so big, you know where it is. Don't be the guy who gets a long spine urchin for your 75-gallon tank, though. That's just asking.
Like, yeah, you're going to get poked.
You're a foot away from that at all times when you're working in that tank.
Right, right. I did a demonstration to demonstrate just how sharp the spines of a long spine urchin are. We had a kindergarten class in, and I decided to put it in my hand. And the weight of the urchin in my hand was enough. The spines were sharp enough that simply the weight of the urchin was enough for them to penetrate my skin and draw a little bit of blood.
Wow.
Yeah. And those things, they it's got to be an ounce or two.
Right.
I mean, that's not an organism that weighs a lot.
Yeah.
It's an amazingly sharp. The spines are specifically designed to break off in flesh, be that the flesh of a fish trying to eat it or a person trying to pick it up or a person stepping on it. They are mildly to non-venomous with most of them of the long spine group. The Diadema, I believe, is the genus on that one. How'd I do there, Charles?
You got it.
Yes.
Mild being it still hurts pretty bad.
No, not really. It's annoying. It's more itchy.
Okay.
But you're going to have a broken off spine in your finger, right? There's some methods for what to do if you have a broken off spine in your finger. They're very hard to dig out because they are so incredibly brittle. So, believe it or not, one of the ways to help with a long spine urchin spine in you is to drink milk.
Really?
Right. The spine is calcium carbonate. If you drink milk, which is high in calcium, your body produces the enzyme that digests calcium. And so your body can actually digest the urchin spine quicker.
That's crazy.
It's fun having friends and clients that are doctors. They teach you stuff like that.
That's insane.
Right. Soaking it in Epsom salt, soaking it in vinegar, those are the other things that can help. Vinegar, by the way, stings like a... It hurts a little bit when you soak it in vinegar, but it does dissolve the spine.
Just a quick note going back to tuxedos. I wrote down... There are some sources that say they are capable of eating coralline algae. So if that's something you want in your system, maybe not your best option.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks they want coralline algae.
I'm pointing at Ben because I know exactly where he's going.
Nobody really wants coralline algae. You want coralline algae because it makes your live rock look pretty. But what you really want is corals to grow on your live rock.
Yes.
And... coralline algae takes the same kind of minerals that coral needs. And it's not really so much a risk of the coralline algae taking up the nutrients or the minerals so the coral doesn't grow as well. It's really a matter of if you put your energy into growing corals instead of growing coralline algae, you don't have to scrape coralline algae off of your glass. Which, coming from an aquarium maintenance company perspective, that is a pain in the...
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. So coralline algae, bad, not my friend.
No. I think a lot of people want it because it gives the illusion of like a mature aquarium. It really only takes hold in tanks that are a little bit older. So like that pure white base rock look is like, oh, you just set your tank up.
Yeah.
Well, that and alluding back to what Ben's talking about with the... rising popularity of nanograms, I think coralline algae will start to become less and less favorable. At least I hope so, because coralline algae, as competitive as it is for those resources, I have seen it and it has the potential to kill corals because it will strip those resources faster than you can dose them in small aquaria.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. I don't know of anything that like... is a guaranteed get this and it will eat coralline algae.
The tuxedo urchin is one of the highest percentages of will eat coralline algae.
I've definitely seen some Asterinas on it. Next time we do, we should split one out. And because there's a lot of different... Asterinas are those like teeny tiny mini starfish you'll see in a reef aquarium. Right. And I've seen them on it before. It might be something we want to play around with.
Let's try it, Mr. Breeding Lab, Live Food Lab Guy.
Yeah.
Let's do an experiment with Astrian Stars and Coralline Algae.
Making a note.
Excellent.
Add it to the list.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So we talked about snails. What are the snails we don't like?
Cone snails.
Well, no. Yeah. Those guys are bad. So moon snails and bumblebee snails. Those are two snails that are commonly sold in the aquarium hobby as fantastic snails for your reef aquarium. Those snails come from more northern or temperate water. So the temperatures we like to keep in a reef aquarium dramatically reduce the life expectancy of both moon snails and bumblebee snails. They're often talked about as a fantastic snail for reef aquarium. They should be a 5 to 10 year snail, and at 78 degrees, they're going to live about a year and a half.
Yeah, that's a bummer.
Yeah, which gives them, you know, enough validity for many people that can say, hey, I have them for a year and a half. But bumblebee snails, bad. Moon snails are another one. They don't like tropical temperatures. So those are two snails commonly sold in the hobby. Please don't buy them. Please tell your store to stop carrying them. I will tell my distributors, and I have told them, to stop carrying those snails because they're not good for reef aquariums.
I really don't like nerites in reef aquariums for similar reasons to the cerithes. They want to walk away.
They do want to walk away. Yeah, that's true. That's a good call.
Yeah, that's the only other snail, though, that I'm like, I definitely don't like. Because Nassarius are fantastic snails. If we're ready to get into sand sifters, I'm willing to talk about Nassarius.
Nassarius like are super fun. Too. Yes. Conchs in a big tank.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about conchs. I love them.
Yeah. So not only are conchs just fantastic sand sifters, they're gonna dig through and they'll really clean your sand bed really well, but they are just like the most ridiculous things you can have. They're big googly eyes, they're elephant trunks. Like, it's a blast to have a conch in a tank if you've got a tank that's the size for one.
They can jump.
Yeah, they do. They can launch themselves. They can even climb up the glass. I've seen it before.
Yeah.
They're amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Strawberry conchs, fighting conchs, tiger conchs. Those are all the really...
Sand conchs.
Yeah.
Yep.
There aren't too many that we see for trade very often that are like any of the bigger conchs that you just couldn't do.
Yeah. I have seen queen conchs offered for sale. Have I? Yes, I've seen them offered for sale. They had all kinds of disclaimers and things like that. And they were farm-raised conchs. They were not wild-caught conchs. You got to have one giant system to keep a queen conch for sale.
Yeah,
queen conch.
Nassarius are basically like mini conchs. If you've got something less than 75 gallons, go for Nassarius instead.
Yep, they're a great choice.
Yeah.
They're probably, for anything small, they're probably the best sand sifter out there.
I would say so. Yeah. Because most sand sifters, I think, everybody thinks that they need one, but most of them go through so much sand that your 5 square feet of sand is not enough for them. You could say that about conchs. You could say that about sand sifting stars. You can say that about the sand sifting gobies.
The diamond sleeper goby is one we get asked about all the time. Mm-hmm. If you want to clean out your sand bed as quickly as possible, put a diamond sleeper goby in there.
And then figure out what to do with
and
it.
And then figure out how to feed it. And that's the problem. Every once in a while, we get one that eats pellet food.
Yeah.
It's so rare. We've really stopped carrying them. We get asked about them all the time. And I know about 3/4 of the people that I try to give the plea to that, please just, you know, watch those guys. They're just not really a good choice. They go buy them somewhere else. And I don't know how to fix that one with them.
Yeah, and often too, they'll take mice as easily, and we can get them on pellets, but like, we put one in our 220 one time, and within an hour the sand was basically clean.
Yeah. And then what?
And then you got to just feed it like a normal fish, but it's at the bottom.
Yep.
Yeah. It's pretty depressing to watch. Like, I've seen them in tanks as large as like 600 gallons. And all you do is watch it slowly starve.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not fun.
They can sift an amazing amount of sand.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And it's important to note, too, that when we're talking about sand sifting, we're not necessarily talking about, although partially we are, getting into the sand and eating a bunch of stuff. Part of the action that actually makes that healthy for your tank is just stirring up stuff that can then get sucked into your filter. So that's something you can perform yourself just as well as most sand
Stir
sifters.
Stir that sand every once in a while.
And
we are advocates here of a thinner sand bed.
Mm-hmm.
the deep sand bed has a lot of, there's a lot of good theories behind it, and the no substrate tanks, there's a lot of good theories behind that too. I simply don't like the way a no substrate tank looks. It's purely an aesthetic thing for me. So a shallow sand bed that gives you that look of the ocean bottom with a few sand sifters like Nosara sails in there, it could be a great tank.
Yeah, bare bottom to me looks great for a picture. But then algae starts to grow, coralline starts to grow. Like, you can have one that looks really cool, but they're much higher maintenance, I think, to keep them looking cool.
Yeah, I agree.
I feel the need to comment on Nosara snails because they're probably one of the... off the top of my head, that's probably the one invert cleanup crew member that I truly love, which is a big statement coming from me. In my family, we like to call them zombie snails.
Oh, yeah.
Because they have those like little antennae that'll pop up when you're feeding. And then once they realize, oh, you are feeding something, they will come up out of the sand and be like, try to find whatever you're doing.
They look like a zombie climbing up out of a out of a grave.
It's amazing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
The move when we've got a tank full of them, like, that are buried in the sand, and you're like, okay, I'm going to catch some Nosarius, and you just scoop, and you know exactly where it is because you can see his little snorkel. That's pretty good. That's a good move.
Yep.
I will comment that they do seem to be more prone than other snails to be eaten by things, at least in my experience.
True.
That's because their proboscis looks like a worm.
Yeah. But I've seen things like shrimp go after them.
Yep.
Like large shrimp.
I've seen tangs go after them.
So just a fair warning to those out there.
Yeah, their protection isn't as like complete as the snails that are crawling up rocks and things like that, because they do have to be a little vulnerable to come out of the sand and like crawl around openly.
It takes them a little while to bury themselves back under.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they have to get out of the shell to do that.
Right.
A little bit.
Right. Yep. All right, so we talked about snails, we talked about urchins, we talked about fish. How about we touched on sea stars. We should talk about sea stars.
Yeah, because I did mention the sand sifting star, and really that is only a solution for a big tank, I think.
Yes, they will strip a tank quickly.
And they get quite large. I think they get like 10 inches in diameter.
I've never seen one that big, but maybe that's a problem.
Yeah, but how many tanks do you know that are that much more than 10 inches wide even?
Yeah.
In my notes, I wrote down... according to the scientific literature, a sand sifting star is capable of growing a foot across.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think a 6-inch one is about the biggest I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Which is kind of telling. You know, it's kind of like when you talk about iridescent sharks. I've never seen an adult iridescent shark, and that's because they don't get that big.
Right.
They don't survive long enough to get that big in an aquarium. Maybe it's the same with sand sifting stars.
It could be. Or if, echinoderms are products of their environment. So it could be food resources too, that they can't get that big because they literally just cannot get that much food in our tanks.
I wonder why I've never seen them that big at a wholesaler.
I don't know. Because you'd think that they would be caught at that size sometimes.
Yeah.
Fun fact. So the ability of inverts to do like grow to various sizes depending on their environment has a very specific term. And to my knowledge, I cannot think of any modern vertebrates that do it, but a lot of invert species do it. It's called phenotypic plasticity. Mm-hmm. And it's the ability to just like, and it doesn't have to apply to just body size, but it's just, this is as big as I can function in my environment, so I'm just going to be here. It's not really like they're stunted. It's just, that's what they can do with what they got. Now, I'm not saying that in an aquarium that's what you should be shooting for.
Right.
I'm just saying that there are many species of inverts that are capable of doing that, just as a fun factoid.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of, I've seen, this is one of those pieces of information that I have no foundation for, but I see it passed around a lot, which is that, the only reason we can't have gigantic insects is because we don't have enough oxygen in our environment, and that's, the only limitation.
Right.
So, It's a similar thought.
Yeah.
The crustaceans have, or is it all arthropods? I believe it's all arthropods have an open respiratory system, whereas instead of blood or some other thing pumping oxygen to the various cells, they have little bitty tunnels all over the place that bring the oxygen directly to them. And you can only bring that oxygen so deep before something else takes it all up. In the water, you can get that oxygen in farther, because the water can transport the oxygen easier than the air can. But in the air, that's the size limiting, and that's why they can't get that big.
So funny.
That's the reason why things like, you know, king crabs exist in water, but we don't really see bugs walking around that size.
There's no dragonflies with 3-foot wingspans.
No, but there are those creepy, like, coconut crabs.
Yeah.
Those guys are cool.
They're really cool.
Yep. Yep.
Anyway, we could talk about bugs forever.
So there's another type of star that we haven't touched on here, and I'm waiting for someone to bring it up because just...
Are you referring to the brittle star?
Yeah.
Yes.
I love brittle stars.
They're so fun.
Do you know something taxonomically? They are not sea stars.
Right.
They are... Brittle stars are their own thing. So I had to write it down. I remember this from college, but I would never remember the actual terms. So sea stars are in the class Asteroidae. Brittle stars are in the class...
Start with an O.
Yep. Ophiuridae.
Ophiuridae, right. And that's class level.
Yes.
So that would be the difference between... A sea star and a brittle star are as different as a bird and a frog.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's wild to think about. But if you ever get into like deep sea stuff, which we're not going to talk about much here, but there are a lot of brittle stars.
There are a lot of brittle stars.
Like you don't see too many of them up at like the shallow reef level, but there are a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're so fun when you get one of the big ones, a big brittle star in your hand. It has 5-point radial symmetry, right? Which humans have bilateral symmetry, right? We have a left and we have a right. 5-point radial symmetry means, just like with human, a left and a right really is kind of equal. Every leg on a sea star, actually with the entire phylum Echinodermata,
should be... Brittle stars, sea stars, urchins, all that kind of
thing. Sea cucumbers, mm-hmm. Right? 5-point radial symmetry. Every leg on a brittle star is just as forward or backward as any other leg. So there's really not a front and a back. There's a top and a bottom, but there's not a front and a back or a backwards or a forwards. There's a... You can't even relate to that. Like there's a back one, back two, back three, back four, and back five. Or front one,
like
front two, front four.
There's 30 degrees and then...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
My head can't wrap around that.
They have 5 teeth. They have 5 appendages or a multiple of 5 for their appendages. 5-point radial symmetry. Why the number 5, why that is, I don't know evolutionarily why, but 5-point radial symmetry is cool.
Because stars are pretty.
Oh, yeah, that's it.
Yes.
Yeah. But I knew there was a reason.
Should we even be talking about brittle stars as cleanup crew? Because they do something, but not a lot.
They're a pretty decent detritivore.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, this is going to get to the when we talk about the last stage of the discussion. Mm-hmm. Brittle stars will play a big role in that point of the discussion.
Well, yeah. And it's to talk about it as a detritivore, and that's sort of what we're going to be coming to is... Algae eaters are a patch to solve a problem that exists, the symptom of a problem that exists.
Yes.
Yeah. So something like a detritivore may even be a more valuable cleanup crew member because it might stop that from becoming a problem in the first place.
True.
Yeah.
Are there any other groups of cleanup crew we haven't talked about?
We haven't really talked about sea stars in general. We've talked about brittle stars because Charles made sure to point out that they were different.
Go ahead.
I was about to say, I'm just smirking behind the mic here. So.
It's a good point.
Most of the sea stars are not really great cleanup crew. They're detritivores and bacterialivores. Is that the right?
Sure.
What's the term for something that eats bacteria?
I think it's a bacteriovore.
That seems too simple.
Probably true. Well, you know, a planktivore eats plankton.
Right, so, that's true. That's true.
At any rate, they don't eat stuff that we would consider pesty.
Hey, that red general star is a necessary part of our shark tank.
He is. He is.
Because he eats all that gunk that they miss.
All the extra stuff. Extra stuff. We should talk about extra stuff soon. Maybe in the third part. I keep alluding to the third part. Yeah, so I don't know that other than a sand sifting star in just the right tank as part of a cleanup crew, I don't know that you can include most of the true sea stars as part of a cleanup crew. There's some great ornamental sea stars out there that can be a fine addition to an aquarium, but are they gonna perform a task? Are they gonna be utilitarian or are they just ornamental?
Yeah, because most of them don't really eat algae.
No.
Some of the Asterinas for sure do, but that's sort of a different thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Any other groups of inverts or groups of critters that we're missing?
I have a few that I want to touch on just in passing. We get asked a lot about shrimp. At least I do.
Yeah.
I would not consider them a member of your cleanup crew personally.
But they're cleaner shrimp.
Yes. Yeah. So that's a different function.
Good segue. What does a cleaner shrimp do? They keep your tank clean, don't they?
No.
By the way, I know the answer.
So when you're talking about a cleaner organism, at least on the reef, in that context, you're referring to an organism that, I don't want to say is specialized, but is capable of picking parasites off of other organisms. So things like the, what do we call them here? The blood reds or the scarlet shrimps?
Blood red cleaners or scarlet cleaners.
Okay. And then the
skunks.
And the skunks, they will all perform that function. I think the skunks are more well known for that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the scarlets are a little bit more bashful, I guess is the phrase I want to use.
The banded coral shrimp also does a great job of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although I sometimes worry about them because the banded corals are a little bit more capable of taking out some things in your tank.
They do have some pretty substantial claws, and they have those for a reason.
Yeah. Peppermint shrimp are probably something that I guess I would call closest to a clean up crew.
Yeah.
More like a pest removal, I guess.
Right.
Well, that is a section we haven't talked about yet.
Yeah.
In this case, peppermint shrimp are known for eating, I'm suddenly blanking.
Aptasia,
thank you.
Sometimes Mejanos.
I will say they are not miracle workers. They are not capable of taking out Aptasia that is as large as themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They are very good at, I should say fairly good at eating them when they're still small. So I think they're better at preventing new waves of Aptasia from forming in your tank than removing an already existing population.
Sometimes you got to watch those guys, though. Sometimes they don't read the book. I mean, we do freely put them in most reef tanks, but every once in a while I've seen them go into a reef tank and go, ooh, look, it's a frog spawn coral, and just rip it into little bits and pieces.
Yeah, if you've got a priceless LPS, I'd probably skip them. But I have added them to a 75 with an Aptasia infestation, added three of them in there, shot whatever big Aptasias I could with some Aptasia remover, and they cleaned up the rest of it, and it did not come back.
They will.
So under the right circumstances, they can really get the job done.
They will do the job on the little ones
caution.
For sure. With caution.
Yeah.
Yep.
What is our sourcing for peppermint shrimp?
Our peppermint shrimp are Caribbean peppermint shrimp.
Okay.
Yes, and so, we know that for sure, and there is a good reason for that.
That answers the question that leads me into that behavioral differences that we see can be explained that there are three species of Caribbean peppermint shrimp, and they are well known for having varying degrees of Aptasia eating capabilities.
I didn't know there were three. I knew there were two, the camel shrimp and the true peppermint.
Yeah. So the camel shrimp are, to my knowledge, are a different genus.
Okay.
But the peppermints within that genus, there are three that I'm aware.
There's still Lesmata, right?
Yes, there's still Lesmata, but there's I meant to say within that complex.
Okay.
There are three peppermint shrimp, and they're nearly indistinguishable to me anyways, but like you would have to get a invert expert to be able to be like, oh yeah, this is clearly this species and blah,
ooh,
blah, blah.
Sounds like we need to figure that out.
Yeah, I think they are traded to us with a species name, but whether or not that's accurate, their guess may be as good as ours in that case.
Right.
One more group that I think no one's really talking about enough. Amphipods and copepods.
The trouble with talking about it is you can't see them. So I want one, but I can't see it, so it must not be real.
Yeah.
Some of those amphipods are definitely pretty decent size.
Yeah. So I wrote down some notes. So for amphipods, if you know what a scud looks like, that is a freshwater amphipod. So they are more or less going to live on live rocks. If you have, or in your live rock, if you have mandarins, that's what they're hunting and pecking at.
Dragonets.
And they're detritivores, and they're great for film algaes. They're only really good at phytoplankton in your water column during their, what's the word I'm looking for?
Planktonic stage,
thank you. I would argue that copepods probably, and I'm completely speculating here, I think the hobby, if it wants to be moving in a more quote-unquote naturalistic direction, we need to be finding a way to be working with copepods in our systems more readily. So I've seen, I won't say a lot, but some literature that's pointing to that corals in the wild, part of the reason that they grow so much faster in the wild than they do in our tanks is that they are prolific filter feeders.
Absolutely.
The majority of that is copepods. Guess what we have a shortage of in our aquarium system?
I bet you're going to say copepods.
It's copepods. And with more and more products like that are microalgaes, like PhytoFeast. What's the one we have downstairs? It's the cecum one.
Oh, it's just Reef Phytoplankton.
Reef Phytoplankton. With more and more products like that, I think getting copepods to do better in your system is more and more viable. But I also think that those phytoplanktons are useful just for your corals, because that is also something they'll be eating. So I think if you want, and again, clearly speculating because no one has really experimented with it, I think if you want to see that kind of growth that we see in the wild, that might be the next step in the hobby, because I think we've pretty honed down lighting at this point.
Yeah. I think one of the issues might be rushing the cycle, getting fish in there too fast. Fish, that's like their favorite thing to eat. It's like copepods on rocks. So I wonder if we just slowed down, let things cycle a little bit longer, if we would see greater populations that can be better sustained.
I think copepods are something that you're going to have to also like artificially bump up in population, because copepods are the most common form of plankton in the ocean. If I'm remembering correctly, they account for like 70% of the planktonosphere. They're insane.
That's a crazy amount considering the amount of things that are part of the planktosphere.
Yeah. So I think that's why I'm of the opinion of, I think we're going to have to start experimenting. We as the hobby as a whole are going to have to be experimenting in that direction if you want to keep advancing coral growth.
I think we already are a little bit, because that's part of what the whole refugium thing is working toward, having some macroalgae in there that's great production habitat for that food and for that stuff. Yeah, exactly. So to that thing that is becoming more and more popular, to think of it with that mindset as well, I think like makes it even more valuable.
I fully agree, because only within the last like 5 years have we started being able to identify copepod species that are benthic during their adult stage but are planktonic during their like younger stages.
Right. And the benthic ones are going to be the ones that are going to be part of your cleanup crew.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're also going to be the ones that can live and breed in your refugium, but when they're breeding, that's what's going to be feeding your corals.
Right. I like it.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah.
I hadn't even thought to bring up pods.
One of the classic rules of a stable ecosystem is the more diverse an ecosystem is, the more stable it is.
Yeah.
That's an ecosystem in an aquarium or an ecosystem in the wild. It's an argument for monoculture. It's an argument for live rock. It's an argument against monoculture. It's an argument for live rock, all that kind of stuff.
It's an argument against sterile aquariums, which are antithetical.
Quick
and
little...
And boring.
Quick little comment. I'm one of those people that, despite the type of person that is prone to species aquariums, I am not overly fond of monocultures, to the point where I actually despise the look of lawns.
Yeah.
That's a whole nother topic. So, you know, we need to talk on the fact that when we're talking about cleanup crews, we're talking about trying to get a bunch of critters to do stuff either because we're not doing something right or we're doing something wrong.
Yeah.
So I started alluding to the section 3 of this talk. And this is kind of where I want to go to right now, right? Like, why are we getting algae? Why do we need something that's going to be a detritivore? What are the sources of detritivore? What are the sources of algae? What are the reasons we need a peppermint shrimp to clean up all the aptasias? Why are aptasias going crazy?
Yeah, perhaps an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Yeah.
What?
Yes. I think that's definitely what we would all prefer to say about cleanup crew is treat issues as they arise, but stop those issues from happening in the first place.
Right. If your Asterina stars are growing out of control and growing like crazy, they are reproducing based on the available resources. We are their resources.
Mm-hmm. And that goes for everything in your tank. Every living thing in your tank, you are their resource. That includes algae. That includes Aptasia. Right. That includes Mijanos. All of that. If you're the only one putting things into that, let's call it an ecosystem, I'm going to not split that hair.
All right.
Then you are the one feeding that algae and feeding those pests.
That's at least if you include freshwater, that's an almost daily discussion I have with customers. Like, why am I getting all these snails? It's like 99.7% of the time, it's one reason.
I think you're underestimating the percentage of time a little bit, personally.
Yeah, and it all comes down to feed less.
Feed less.
Yes.
We could just end it right there.
I mean,
we're not gonna,
honestly,
but we could just end
honestly,
it right there. Yes.
Like, and with reef fish, I feel like it's even harder, especially because you probably have a couple of different layers in your tank, mm-hmm. and some fish are more territorial than others, and they all eat different foods. You can't always just give like one pellet for everybody. So overfeeding in a saltwater tank is easy to do.
It's easy to do. We live in the Midwest. It's considered heroic to overeat here.
Yeah. So any rotten food in the tank, anything in there that's getting caught up, maybe you don't even have enough flow, stuff like that, that's going to decompose. That's going to produce more nitrates in your tank. It's going to feed algae. Algae can feed pests. It's the whole cycle. It needs to start with how much you're putting into the tank.
It all works together.
Mm-hmm.
Either how much you're putting into the tank or how much you're taking out of it.
Yeah.
An undersized protein skimmer, not enough mechanical filtration, not properly managed mechanical filtration.
Yeah.
All of those things that can manage those nutrients that feed algae. One of the, I love it when a gardener comes in who becomes a reefer because they all understand what the NPK reading is on fertilizers.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are a gardener and you go shop for a fertilizer for your African violets versus the fertilizer for your roses, there's going to have that different NPK rating. That NPK is the nitrogen, phosphate, and potassium rating. Those are the main ingredients in plant fertilizers. Algae uses the same kind of nutrients that plants use. Yes, I'm distinguishing algaes are not plants.
Close enough.
No. I'm going to draw a line there.
For the sake of this discussion, it certainly is.
Right. I could tell that he was chomping at the bit, making sure I was going to make that distinction. So if you're managing nitrates and you're managing phosphates, you're going to also be managing algae. Therefore, you don't need as much of a cleanup crew, or you shouldn't need as much of a cleanup crew. If you come and say, I got an algae outbreak, I need a bunch of cleanup crew, your lights are wrong, your nutrient management is wrong. Nutrient management,
yeah.
That's the word, right? Overfeeding, that counts as nutrient management. Big protein skimmer, that counts as nutrient management. Water changes, mechanical filtration, it's all about nutrient management.
Yeah, we talked about earlier, it's about finding the balance.
Right.
So the balance between nutrients in and nutrients out.
You refer to the one who will bring balance to the tank.
My only regret is that I didn't beat him to that joke.
Cool. You know, I thought that section 3 would be a big log section, but really that's what the gist of it is. So
it honestly is just that simple.
Yeah. Watch your aquarium, read your aquarium. Your aquarium is going to tell you what kind of a cleanup crew you need. And it's also going to tell you how your nutrient management practices are. If you get a sudden algae outbreak, it's always something that was under your control that didn't happen the way that it was supposed to. I tried to say that in like this really non-accusatory way, right?
Well, the fact of the matter is when you come in and you tell me you have an algae problem, please don't get frustrated with me when I ask you, what's your lighting schedule? What's your feeding schedule? What's your water change schedule? Because if you have an algae problem, one of those three things is wrong.
Can I just get a sucker fish?
If only.
If only. If yeah.
No.
Yeah, it's that simple. I think we're good.
So summarization here real quick. We're gonna breeze through the cleanup crew we like, the ones we don't like, and then summarize our little thing at the end, right? So we do like some snails.
Let me interject in here. Let's reword that as, let's make a distinction between the organisms that we like as cleanup crew and the organisms that we like but aren't great for cleaning up.
That we consider a good part of a cleanup crew and a non-essential or non-necessary or even shouldn't be part of a cleanup crew.
Because I love skunk cleaners.
Yep.
I know, and some hermit crabs are really fun, yeah. Right? So Nassaria snails, Astrea snails, Turbo snails, Trochus snails.
Fantastic.
We like those guys. Mm-hmm. We like a lot of the sand sifting snails, we like a lot of the sand conchs, just not the really big ones.
Yeah. And the little Nassarias, great snails for urchins, sand sifting.
Wow, you got to use urchins with caution because some of them just can just be...
Some of them can literally kill you.
Many of them just like to push stuff around. Some can poke you. Some can do just fine. And some are in between.
Yeah. Sea stars are pretty, but they're probably not going to do you that much good.
They're not going to do a whole lot for you.
Same for shrimp most of the time.
If you feel like you need a brill star in your tank...
Do it.
Do it. But not because you need it to help clean up your tank.
If you even feel like you kind of like a brittle star, do it.
Yeah. We didn't even touch on the green brittle stars. Oh, I'm sorry. I know we're getting close to the end here.
Well, the red ones,
the
too.
The giant green brittle star. No, the giant green brittle star is so cool. And sometimes I've seen them for sale at wholesalers and sometimes for sale. Like I've walked into a store and I've seen a giant green brittle star for sale. They're a fish predator.
I'm sure. Any right. ones that get that big.
Yeah. Well, what they do, they very specifically hunt. They really don't eat much other than fish.
Really?
And so they maneuver themselves into a cave and they use their big, huge 10, 12, 14 inch long arms to prop themselves up inside that cave. And they wait for a fish to hide in that cave and then they drop themselves on top of it. So if you have
amazing.
A giant green brittle star, if you have a green brittle star, don't keep it with fish. It will eat them.
Yeah. You want the little black ones or the little red ones?
Yeah, those guys are cool. Even the ornate ones. Right. What else? Oh, fish. Fish we like.
Yeah.
Make sure you have a fish that is appropriately sized for your tank. Mm-hmm. No growing to the size of your tank doesn't count. They don't do that. No, you don't get rid of it when it gets big. You keep
Thank
a fish
you.
Like you
I,
keep
I wanna
a dog.
I want to double down on that. Like, yeah. I'm not into that mentality of... Like, I'll cycle through them. Like, when they get too big, I'll get rid of them and get another small one. Like, don't do that.
That's not okay.
No.
You can't do that with children. You can't do that with dogs. You can't do that with fish. Don't do it.
Unless, I've heard of a couple people who have somebody specifically set up at the beginning, but you got to have the plan. And even still.
And donating it to somebody is not a thing.
No.
Nope.
No.
If you want a big fish, get a big tank. If you want a fish that's going to get a big tank. If you can't get a big tank... Get a little fish. Get a fish that stays little. Sorry. Tangent. Another one of those. Okay, so we covered the fish.
Fish
we talked about
tanks,
urchins.
Rabbit fish, even the sand sifting goby in a bigger tank.
It's gotta be huge.
Yeah.
Like maybe, I don't know, 6 square feet, 8 square feet per sand sifting goby.
Yeah, big tank.
Yeah.
Yep. We did not talk about the cucumbers and the nudes, the nudibranchs.
Right. Actually a lot of the sand sifting cucumbers can survive and do a lot better long term than a lot of the other sand sifters can.
Yeah, but still big tanks.
Bigger.
Yeah, bigger. Just not nanos.
Just not nanos. Yep.
Yeah. There are some algae eating nudibranchs. And really, I think for the algae eating cucumbers and the algae eating nudibranchs, they just need too much. You can't keep up.
Emerald crabs, cool. Hermit crabs, fun, but not part of a cleanup crew and bad for snails.
Yeah.
Yeah. The big takeaway from this entire discussion is, yes, there are some cleanup crew creatures that we want to have in our tanks, and some because they're fun, and some because they're cool, and some because they make our job a little bit easier. Nutrient management is the best cleanup crew you can have.
Absolutely.
Yep. Well.
No arguments there.
That kind of summed it up. Hopefully we raised some eyebrows. Hopefully we made a couple of people question what they're doing. Hopefully we made a couple of people want to question us and how we're doing and why we're doing what we're doing. And please leave us some comments. Let us know what you think. Tell us your opinion on cleanup crews. Is there something out there that you put in your tank that all of a sudden some pest you had disappeared?
And I feel like this is the topic that I think thus far in the podcast has the most potential for people to innovate with. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
Like, work through it. Like,
yeah.
This is, yeah. The hobby sure. needs to always be improving.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And finding that little thing that gets that one thing that's driving you nuts out of your tank is very, very satisfying.
Always trying to make it better. Always trying to have fun. And hey, let's keep those hands wet.